But first up on today's show, my first guest is a child and adolescent psychotherapist with the St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, who, though a technology addict himself, has taken a keen interest in the effects of contemporary media on child development and mental health. His book, Cop On, What It Is and Why Your Child Needs It to Survive and Thrive in Today's World, which was published a couple of years ago, is considered a seminal work on the subject, and it's becoming more and more challenging by the day. I'm delighted to welcome Colman Nochter to Late Lunch. Colman, good to see you.
Jerry, how are you doing?
Thank you very much for joining me on the show. Now, 2 years ago, you published this book. And again, I know it's 2 years belatedly. What a wonderful work it is and remains. 2 years on, Colman, surely we're being swamped by a tsunami here.
Yeah, well, I think on the front of technology, 2 years is an era in that sense. And I suppose a lot has changed in that space. Unfortunately, not changed for the better in terms of our awareness of our own usage of technology, our response to the possible risks of technology. I think what you'd hope is that people would learn a bit more to kind of hold a mirror up to their own usage, which was, again, my own kind of epiphany around that time was realizing just how insipid and kind of how it kind of creeps in on family life, on work life and our relationships, etc. And, you know, over the last 2 years, I've been around the country talking to lots of people about this topic. And it's still the passion for people to hear about it and to speak about it is really very strong. Our impetus to do something about it is perhaps not as quick. And I think it's a seductive technology that makes it really difficult to manage it or to keep an eye on it or to curtail it or to even regulate it. And I do think it's a relationship with technology. I think in much the same ways we think about relationships with food, alcohol, gambling, I think it is a relationship that forms over time. And I suppose it's something about an awareness of how that relationship is affecting our lives on a day-to-day basis and maybe trying to keep that in check is probably what the message still says. But we've had all these kind of different things that have come in the last 2 years, different challenges for parents, different apps, different... I know the kind of semi crisis of the early this year and different type of challenges that young people are getting into. We're kind of seeing issues around sexting and pornography and all these kind of discussions that have come out since I've written it, which I guess a volume two is due at some point.
It must be imminent at this stage. But you know what you say there about addictions and traditionally addictions to alcohol, to smoking, to drugs? Is this even more pervasive than any of those? You know, everybody has access to this. You don't fall about the place, you know, if you're addicted to this, but yet its effects are shocking.
Yeah, I suppose I worry with the idea of addiction because I think it narrows people's view of what it might be. I mean, for me, a lot of us have problematic relationships with technology, and that you only realise you're addicted to a substance when you can't get it. So I would challenge anyone to forget their phone someday and watch the reaction of you know, it is like a limb, and it becomes something that, and I think especially when I talk to young people about this, I'd researched this as my PhD area for 5 years, and one of the terms that kept coming up, people kept using the phrase, my phone is my security blanket. So it's this kind of relationship that, and it's not a device for just contacting other people, which a phone used to be, because we have our schedules, our pictures, our thoughts. Some people use it as a dream diary. You know, even really intimate things are put onto the device, and so it becomes something much, much more important to us. And that problematic relationship becomes when it starts to usurp other important things in our life, like communication, like speaking at family times, like using mealtimes as an opportunity for people to talk about, or, you know, even just waiting in a queue and sparking up a conversation with somebody. I think the idea that our problematic relationship, not like alcohol or gambling, where there's a kind of a financial fallout or a family fallout or a kind of an observational crisis. Many of us don't realize just quite how dependent, I guess, we are on our devices. And, you know, in our house last year, the Wi-Fi went on the day before Christmas Eve, and it was only then that you kind of realise, you know, your internet banking, your Netflix, your entertainment, your connection to the world, it becomes much more difficult. And I was asked once, you know, do I think there's going to be this revolution where we're all going to down our phones and kind of and respond by saying not anymore? And I don't think there is, because I think we already are hooked in, if that makes sense. We've become so dependent on it.
It's too late. Is that what you're saying to me? It is too late at this stage. This is unstoppable. It's like a juggernaut coming down the road. We can talk about it. We can make suggestions, but
I don't know whether it's coming down the road. I think it's here.
Yeah.
And I think there's for me, the internet is the greatest social experiment of our time. And I mean that because we don't have any knowledge of the outcome. Now, we can hear studies that will say, you know, we've looked at this and it helps learning and it might help problem solving, or it might help all these things. And I wouldn't dispute any of those things. But emotionally and relationship wise, we do not have any longitudinal evidence over time to suggest whether it's good or it's bad. And for that reason, it's that the iPhone baby is not yet 8, you know, from the point of view of that. So, and people will say the internet has been around since the 90s, and perhaps it has, but that's for a very select few of people who maybe lived in their mother's basement and were aware of those things. It really, the game changer was 2010, when the handheld device became a thing, and it really did change our relationship, because it wasn't just the PC in the corner of the room that we used to go to, it now was an actual extension of ourselves. And I think that, like, in relative terms, our relationship with technology is in its infancy. You know, we really have not developed a kind of, and I think we're still romanticized by technology. We still love what it can do. We still feel great. And when you're going around giving these talks, I mean, something like, you feel like one of the kind of anti-smoking campaigners in the 50s, or, you know, David McWilliams in The Boom. People are kind of going, oh, don't gloom on it. We're really loving this thing. But for me, I just think we've invited this into our homes, into our lives, into our relationships, and into our children's lives, at the phase where it's still an experiment. And I wouldn't be sure that we would do that with anything else, in terms of, you know, would we take a pill that we didn't know the outcome to? We wouldn't. And I, of course, I'll be accused of scaremongering and all of those things, but without the evidence, it is still experimental. And I think when involved in any experiment, we need to just be really conscious about that relationship and how it develops and how it gets in on us, and how that relationship develops. And I think perhaps sometimes we just don't ask enough questions. Mm. And I always go back to the point of when we got the first landline, like, it was, if I ask anyone, any of your listeners, where was it put? And they'll answer, it was in the hall. And that's exactly where it was, because it didn't interrupt the family life. It was there for a reason. It was there for privacy, I guess. And then you had that second phone, you know, it might have gone into your parents' bedroom. If that rang after 9 o'clock, somebody had died. You know, it was that kind of a big issue. But there was reasons for that, whereas now this has become an extension of us, and there is no element of our lives where it doesn't play a role. Yeah.
But are you saying to me, in another way, that the jury's neither out nor in on this? It's an experiment. We're not too sure. We're at early doors, even though the juggernaut, as he said, has nearly mowed us all down at this stage. But could this be good? Could this be a real good thing? Or what does your gut tell you?
My gut says that it's not bad technology. I think the technology is good. I think it's bad usage. And I think we are like infants with the usage of it. We are not regulating it in a way that we should do it. And again, it's not like we can manage it in terms of our health, or like a healthy diet, or the meat and two veg of kind of face-to-face communication, and then we have the treat of technology. It's everywhere. And I don't know whether one of the big things that you said, that the book was 2 years ago, and one of the major issues that I would say around the book is that, but at that time, you're writing it from the point of view of saying there's parents out there who say, I can't access my daughter because she's stuck behind a screen. The difference now is I speak to young people who say, I can't access my mam because she's stuck behind a screen. And that is the difference, because we have the biggest cohort of people to move onto Facebook in the last 5 years are 35 to 50 year olds. We're behind the curve, but we've taken a kind of, if we can't beat them, join them approach to it. And for me, that is worrisome, because there's no adults in this who are managing the experiment, if that makes sense.
And so adults as well are only engaging with this for the first time. So they are in effect like their children. Children are probably more streetwise about this, in effect, than their parents. So who's running the show, as you say? This has to be, it's getting worse by the minute, as I talk to you.
No, I mean, people will say it's the service providers are running the show because they're collecting all this data on us that we are voluntarily giving it about our likes, our dislikes, our emotionality, and technology is becoming more humanized. But the worry is that humans are becoming less human, if that makes sense. You know, we use terms like, I just have to get through these emails, and we kind of delete them with a kind of a sense of they're disposable. But there's a person at the other end of that email, and sometimes that distance is forgotten through the disconnection. And then that's why you have the kind of cyberbullying, trolling phenomena, that you can't see the reactions of another person. So we're becoming less in tune with our relationships and probably more task-based or more... And since when does answering 57 emails make somebody productive in terms of a workplace or whatever it might be? And, you know, I think... To ask who's in charge, we need to be in charge of it ourselves. And that's why I think we need to hold that mirror up and kind of saying, how much of my life is affected by this? How much of my parenting, how much of my relationships with my siblings, and how much of my leisure time is being affected by this? One of the things I would say is that my worry is that we've become a kind of a mindless society in that respect, because we're losing the space for reflection. And for me, the handheld device is an anti-boredom device. That's essentially what it is. So if you're standing in the queue in Lidl and you work out, you've 6 minutes before you get to the top, you'll escape into your phone for that 6 minutes. You won't spend that time kind of thinking about it. But if I go back to my adolescence, I used lived in the countryside, so I used to get off the bus and I used to phone my mum from the payphone, and, you know, 3 rings and hang up so she knew it was me to save the 20p. Was always very efficient. But in that time, there was a 15-minute wait. So it was me and a bag of school books, which I wasn't going to enter into. So in that 15 minutes, I worked out my next move about, would I like to be a pilot? You know, who am I? Would I like to ask that girl out? What was that about? And kind of worked it through. My fear is that we are removing young people's opportunity to have that boredom. And boredom is a really important task because it allows you to get to know who you are. And if you don't get a chance to know who you are, then your relationship with yourself suffers. If you're looking at mental health, the most important relationship you'll ever have is the relationship you have with yourself. It doesn't matter how successful you are. If you evaluate yourself poorly, that has a negative impact on you. And for me, the mindlessness of being able to be elsewhere all the time almost eliminates our opportunities to get to know ourselves, to have that space. And we talk about mindfulness being very popular at the moment. I think its popularity is probably in correspondence to the mindlessness of a kind of an anti-reflection society that we live in. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, if you wanted to complain about something before, you had to write to the Irish Times, you had to get your paper, your pen, la la la. Now you can troll and put your tweets up left, right and
centre. Just like that. Just like in that. An instant.
And where does the reflection or thought come into that? And I think that's what we have to correspond to technology, is we have to introduce a sense of contemplation of it, rather than just being taken along with the tsunami, as you described it.
Now I know why I love fishing and don't have a phone switched on, and my mind goes, I don't know where. It goes to that time that you talk about, that it just wanders and you think about things and it allows you that space. Don't go anywhere. This is a fascinating man. His name is Coleman Nochter, and we're going to talk more after the break. So, Coleman, you have compared this to perhaps fast food. For one example, fast food. Well, we know fast food, if we eat it every single day of the week, it's not good for us. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. And we don't. Most people don't. Do you believe that we need to deal with this in that fashion? Put it in its place?
Absolutely, I do. I mean, I think in terms of this, for parents, I mean, if your child comes up to you and like, you don't say to your 5-year-old, there's the fridge, there's a 2 litre of ice cream in there, eat it till you get sick. You say, there's a bowl, there's 2 scoops in it, that's a portion. And they'll say, I want more, and you'll say, no, that's enough. So what you're doing is you're teaching your child to develop a relationship with junk food, and you'll go to McDonald's every month or whatever it might be. With that, if you're an adult doing it, you'll notice the bulging waistline, you'll notice that you're kind of not as fit as you were before, and you'll respond to that. The technology stuff isn't as obvious as that. There isn't that kind of cause and effect that's quite as obvious as... But how we regulate our relationship with junk food is exactly how we need to regulate our relationship with technology. And for parents, it's almost like saying, of course you can use your devices, but only after you've had the meat and 2 veg of face-to-face conversation, of, you know, engaging with your sport or whatever it is that you do, your activities. And so it becomes something that complements daily life rather than supplement. A child who uses Facebook for 5 minutes to arrange to meet six of his friends to go playing five-a-side for an hour is a good use of Facebook. But a child who leaves their pals after 5 minutes because they're socially anxious to go back on Facebook and engage in a kind of a computer-mediated communication because that's where they're more comfortable is a bad use of Facebook. And it gets back to, like, the technology isn't bad, but it's the way in which we are engaging with it. You know, if you're, like, using technology for work is really, really good in terms of how we can have a meeting and Skype people in Malaysia or whatever it is. However, how we regulate that is really difficult. In my research, one of the guys said, I'd always email my boss even when he's on holidays. I'd never ring him, but I know he'll answer an email. So there's that sense that someone is always on, that there's no off point. We kind of reward the dysregulation of the guy who's sending emails at 4 a.m. and saying, isn't he very committed? Actually, he's not. He's going to burn out because his time management is really poor. And we need to actually get back into kind of regulating. In France, the work emails have, in certain parts of France, are disabled after 6 o'clock so that you can't get involved in that either. And that also has a corresponding fact of the gentleman who's sending those emails over his breakfast or whatever it might be. And for parents, I'm saying to you, look at your own relationship with technology. If you are stuck to your phone and you're telling your child to come off theirs, that's the same as saying, you know, you eat your porridge while I have a packet of crisps. It doesn't work. We need to almost have, like, cop on is a two-way street. We need to cop on as in order for children to develop those skills. And so it is, it's about moderation. It's not about prohibition. You know, if the idea that we'll plug out devices and we'll never have it, children will find, and young people will find a way around that. I know lots of young people who have 3 Facebook pages, one of which their parents are on and 3 of which they're not. They have 6 SIM cards. You know, they're going around with different devices. So the surveillance advice that I would have given if I was on this show 5 years ago is obsolete. The idea that you can watch your children, and parents will look for parent controls as, you know, these kind of devices. It's not a substitute for parenting. This is about having a conversation with your child to understand what it's like to be there. We need to educate people about how this affects us. Like, young people that I speak to describe this kind of constant hum of anxiety about being on social media, that it's the feedback that's possibly coming or is not coming. And that it almost isn't noticeable by them because it's the way it's always been. You know, if you and I, who have a pre-internet existence, to baseline it against, then we can kind of see the difference. But if it's all you've ever known, then you don't notice it as being different. We have a big problem that, you know, anxiety is the epidemic of our teenagers in the last 5 years. I'm not saying it's a direct correlation, but I'm certainly thinking it's not helping, because I think we, past the kind of social media thing, we live in a very on-demand culture. And we encourage kind of on demand that, but that almost sells an idea that happiness is on demand as well. And any of us who have knowledge of relationships knows that's not true. And so you're trying to bridge a gap. A very simple solution or equation is happiness equals expectation minus reality. And unfortunately, we live in a world that is piling expectations higher and higher, and the realities are creeping up in comparison to it. And the bigger that gap, the greater the propensity for us to be disappointed.
Can I say this to you? We were only talking about this in the office yesterday, and you know when somebody posts something, they're somewhere, they're abroad, or they're at something, or they're enjoying concerts, or blah, and then suddenly people start to think, oh my God, I'm missing out, I do none of this. But isn't that the reality, Coleman, that we're all pretty ordinary folk and we live ordinary enough lives? And, you know, there's a false, that expectation you're talking about being created across this, that's driving that. And it's not right.
But what you're describing is a comparative culture where we live in a much, like, if you and I, we finished school, we'd know how our friends are doing by a 10-year reunion. The population are coming through now are hearing it all the time. They're getting constant feedback of how they're not doing what they should be doing. So if I'm sitting at home watching Graham Norton on a Friday night having a good time, and then I check Facebook and realise that 4 of my mates are out in Marbella playing golf, then all of a sudden my night that was okay up to that point has now dropped because my expectations have shifted that I should be somewhere else. And I think as well-adjusted adults, you can make the distinction between, look, this is my lot, I'll get on with it. But if you're trying to find yourself, and, you know, from up until the ages of 25, we're still in that process of finding ourselves. and you're finding it in that, with that feedback, it becomes incredibly difficult to realise who I am. It's like sculpting a statue of yourself with 600 people giving you feedback with every chip that you make. It becomes, and like we hear lots about the snowflake generation, and are people not, you know, strong enough, or there is there certainly is a resilience deficit that I would see in terms of coping with adversity. But it's also the case that I'm so glad that I'm over 40 and I grew up before this stuff, because it is incredibly much, much more complex and sophisticated to grow up and develop and have an identity in the world today as it was, as opposed to 5-10 years ago.
So there you are. You've just posed the big question, the great challenge that's going to become even more challenging with this thing growing and growing all the time and becoming more pervasive. What would you say in a few words to people listening today, especially parents of children, trying to cope and deal with this? What advice would you hand out?
The big thing I'd say to you, the book is called Cop On because it's about what that is. Cop On is the ability to react to an event in proportion to the event itself. And it's having a good sense of what's important. For me, there's a story of it, very, very quickly. A philosopher comes in, he shows a jar and he fills it with rocks and he asks the class, is it full? And they say yes. Then he gets pebbles and he sprinkles it through the rocks and he says, now is it full? And they say yes. And then he gets some sand and he sprinkles it through the rocks and the pebbles and asks, is it full? And they say yes. And he said, that represents a full life. The rocks are your family, your health, and the really important, meaningful things. The pebbles are how hard you work, how many friends you have, and how well you do in school. And the sand is the cosmetic rubbish that, you know, the likes on Facebook and all that sort of stuff. If you have to teach your child something, teach them what's a rock, what's a pebble, and what is sand. Those children that today are being sold sand, sand, sand. If you fill your life with sand, there's no room for rocks and pebbles. You need to be able to teach children what is meaningful, what's priority, and what's not important. If they have that awareness, then they're equipped to deal with the stuff as it comes to them in terms of selecting it's important, which will impact on how it affects them. And that's the best thing you can do to prepare them for it.
It's a brilliant analogy, because I can just see the jar and I understand what you're saying. There's always room.
What is meaningful? Yes. That is the question that we have to keep asking ourselves. What is important? And if we lose the traditional stuff of what's important, which is a sense of community, support and connection, then we become disconnected in more ways than one.
And have some ground rules as well. It's no harm. They are your children. You have to lay them down. You have to make calls on these things. You can't please them all of the time.
And there's no reason that a child will fall behind socially if they can't check their phone at 2 a.m. in the morning. You know, there's no reason for that. What I would say to you is approach it if we approach it with a way of kind of rules and limits all the time, they will see that as an attempt to control rather than educate. But I would have a chat with your child about what it's like to be online and try and get them to see it. I remember that's a couple of years now, a mum came to me and her kid had done something she shouldn't have done online, and she was removed the phone for 2 weeks. And the first week the mum rang me and said, she's unbearable, she's hissing at me, she's cursing at me, she's swearing, life has become unlivable in the house, I'm thinking of giving her the device back. And I said, well, look, you said 2 weeks, maybe hold out if you can. And I didn't hear back from them. But when I met the mum the second week, she said, can I have a word with you? I said, yeah. And she said, the second week I got my daughter back, we talked in the car. There wasn't the earphones there all the time. We watched X Factor together and we even went for a walk one of the evenings. I haven't seen that child in 3 years. So when you limit that, you will get the detox, you'll get the anger, but there may be something that the child will learn from that will contain that anxiety in the longer term. And I just think from that story, it was less about the fear of the onslaught, but thinking the longer game and what are you telling your child, again, what's important and what is not.
Just before we finish, I'll read one of the messages that I just want to mention here. Angela has been on to say she was in the company of two sisters during the week. One is 6 and the other is 8. And instead of talking to each other, they were texting each other, only sitting about 2 foot away. Sums it up, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, I mean, again, the consensus of the given moment. I mean, through time, we'll have seen how people it just seemed normal at the time. I do believe in 10 years' time, we will look back at this and go, how did we not know that that wasn't a good thing? You know, we're all stuck on our phones, no one's looking up, no one's communicating. Again, with the value of time and hindsight, we may at some point realise there's something not right with this. We need to manage it.
We need to manage it. Hear, hear, I say. Coleman Nochter, thank you so much for dropping in to us on Late Lunch. And just to mention the book again. It's called?
Cop On. Yeah, what it is and why your child needs it to thrive and survive in today's world. But Cop On will do.
There you go. Till the next time, Coleman. Thanks a million.
Thanks.